Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture with me, Padraig Reedy. Ece Temelkuran is an award-winning Turkish novelist and commentator. Her journalism has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Der Spiegel and Frankfurter Allgemeine, and her novels include The Women Who Blew on Knots and The Time of Mute Swans. Ece Temelkuran, welcome to Little Atoms. We're talking today about your new book, How to Lose a Country. This is a book about what the rest of the world, I guess, can learn from what your country, Turkey, has been through. And you start on the night of the coup in 2016, which... In an odd way, was kind of Erdogan's greatest moment. But tell us what happened that night.
The book starts with me in my house and with all the, you know, airplanes running, jets, fighter jets running above us and so on. It's for the rest of the world. It's not about Turkey, in fact. But when you say for them to learn, it's a little bit, I think, bruising for some people's pride. Well, it's been 1 week since the book came out, more than a week now, actually. And I've been doing events, interviews, and so on. So I can feel that people, sometimes some of the people, let's say, feel like, well, what can we learn from Turkey, that crazy country? Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is Great Britain, after all. Mm-hmm. But I try to see through the political mess that we are going through globally, and I try to figure out the main logic of it, because we in Turkey lost a lot of time by getting confused, hesitating, feeling appalled and astonished and so on and so forth. And finally, you know, it was too late sort of for us to understand what's going on, mm-hmm. what was going on. So I wrote the book for other countries, for Europe, for European countries, Britain, and United States. Mm-hmm. So they don't lose the time, they don't lose the energy. Because the book starts with that dark night, and it seemed to us completely impossible for such a night to happen. Mm-hmm. And then it happened. And, you know, one should imagine, I think, one should think about, like, 3 years ago, would it be possible to imagine Brexit? Would it be possible to imagine Trump or, you know, all these right-wing populists popping up several countries? So it wasn't possible for us to imagine the night of the coup in 2016, mm-hmm. On 15th of July. But it happened. And I think when such violence takes place, there is not much place for words anymore, because words are too fragile for such violence. So I went away to Zagreb. I started living there and I started writing this book. It took me 2 years to write, and I hope it tells something to those people who need some sort of clarity, mm-hmm. amidst the political and moral confusion.
Yeah. So... tracing things back, so the point of 2016, where there is the attempted coup in Turkey, and at that point, it's almost as if every paranoid fantasy of Erdogan has come true, and he's able to say, look, I wasn't kidding. whatever you want to call it, the Gulenites or whoever are in the army are against me, and by extension against the people. Mm-hmm. But as a journalist, you've been covering Turkish politics all your career, and you mentioned talking in the book about the 2002 election, and you're out in the provinces meeting people and meeting the various representative of different parties, and at one point you're in a cafe speaking to all the local politicians, and at the back there's three men looking at you and kind of surly.
Yeah, the real people.
Yes, they're the real people. They're very keen to say that they're not like the politicians sitting talking to the journalists. They're the real people.
Yeah.
So, who are these people? And what strikes me as relevant, and it's something that comes across in the book, is that you're meeting these people in the provinces. This is so far away from Istanbul, where normal politics takes place, and you go back to your colleagues and you say, we need to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
But how do they present themselves at them? And what is it that they're trying to say it makes them authentic, as opposed to every other politician who is completely inauthentic?
Yeah, they were, as they are in Britain or in France or in Germany, they were beyond politics, above politics, so mm-hmm. to speak. And they call themselves real people. And this happens in the United States as well. And media, for instance, in the United States, as well as in European countries, cannot know how to handle this situation. Okay, these are real people. So are we out of touch with them? Are we supposed to be like more humble? Are we supposed to be talking about them or let them speak, give the space to them, and so on and so forth? Which we went through, similar questions we went through in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I wrote How to Lose a Country, to win that time, to erase that hesitation. Real people is a new concept. Well, it's not a new concept, but it keep reoccurring sort of throughout human history. There are always people who argue that, who claim that, they are beyond and above politics. They are not dirty politicians and so on. And this time they're coming with the power of social media. They're coming with the power of lobbying companies and so on. And we still do not know how to handle this situation, I think, because the idea that the word real people is so magical. Once it's pronounced, it makes the other one, kind of unreal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you now have to prove that you are real as well.
Yep.
And then the reference of being real people changes time to time. It is quite elusive. And then populist politics, right-wing populist politics especially, runs on this elusiveness. First, it's a class thing. It starts like a class thing or a provincial thing.
Mm-hmm.
We are not the cosmopolitans. We are not going on the plane and going around the world. We are the true owners of this land. And then it becomes a class thing at some point. And then in Turkey, it was very much related to being Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So all the other people, all the cosmopolitans or elites, so to speak, they try to prove that they are Muslims too. And then it became something else. It became, a proud ignorance, a form of proud ignorance.
Yep.
If you're not ignorant enough, you're not real people. And then at the end, at the final stage, it became, if you are truly completely obedient to the regime or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when especially our colleagues from media or intellectuals, academics, should be really careful about this because they tend to hesitate in the name of political correctness when talking about this real people issue. But that's why I wanted to see the main logic through the confusion that right-wing populism creates. When you hesitate, they take on the stage, and the next thing you feel is like you are out of place. You don't have a place there anymore in that discussion table. And it starts from provinces. In Turkey, it did like that. And I think in the United States, in European countries, it's like that. That's why Nigel Farage keeps talking about Dorset pubs and so on.
But the irony there being, of course, Farage, you mentioned, rich man went to one of the country's most expensive schools in London. Donald Trump, very rich man, went to an Ivy League school from New York. You know, Erdogan, not necessarily, not a rich man, but very certainly, you know, an Istanbuler, and they can, you know, not some yokel farmer by any means, you know, a very, very urban metropolitan guy who has some kind of harnessed this idea that, you know, he's from, you know, this Anatolian peasant. How does that stunt work, and how does it keep working?
I think all these men, I'm like, in the book I told a lot about how they resemble each other, how they operate in the same way and so on, but in the heart of the issue lies the crisis of disintegration. We are in the age of disintegration, and I think people are panicking. And when people panic, and we do this on societal level and on personal level, we go back to what we know best. So they want to go back to this promised greatness, this, you know, nostalgia of greatness. And all these leaders, all populist right-wing leaders promise some sort of greatness. So yeah, people want to be great again. That's the thing. And there is a guy who really believes that there will be greatness if they hit the road with him. And people want to believe. You know, human is a strange matter. It always can be activated by hope and, you know, promises.
There's the common theme that, again, that goes through from Putin to Trump to Erdogan to the whole Brexit campaign is the language of respect. Both of them, you must respect the leader, but you also must respect the leader because the leader is the clarion of the people, so to speak. So if you disrespect Trump, you're disrespecting miners and steel workers in Pennsylvania somehow. But there's also, you know, it's gangsterous respect, and it is tied up, I think. Also, the resurgence of this kind of thing in a concept of revenge. And you tell a great story in the book, which I'm going to ask you to open up about, an AK, you know, crony, you know, who went to Istanbul and was told that he had to be a member to get into a nightclub.
This respect issue is very related to this greatness that I have been talking about. I think we have to realize that how much the pride of people is broken through the last several decades, starting from 80s. I think neoliberal system has this perception of human being, and it doesn't consider that human being does need a meaning to live, and it's people needs to be part of a bigger story and so on. A neoliberal neoliberal idea of human being is something like an animal who can operate with the fear of having less and desire to have more, and I think we are seeing the crisis of that. That's why people respond to the promise of greatness. When you look at Turkey, when you look at Russia, United States, or any other European country, there's a pride issue. There's a broken pride there. That's why people are so outraged and they are on the streets. And that energy comes from that righteous anger, in fact. But unfortunately, it is organized and mobilized by wrong people, obviously. And that story about the guy, one of the real people in Turkey, in Turkish provinces, that happened in 2002, I think. He was a guy, you know, with a little business. And then obviously he wanted to go to Istanbul, to one of these big clubs. Probably they, you know, they didn't take him in, and they said, like, you know, you need a membership card or something. And when I was interviewing him, he said, you know, do I really need a, you know, membership card to go into a discotheque or a club, whatever? And I said, no. And I saw the rage in his face. And then on, after 10 years, he was actually owning that club. And he turned that club into a place that only people like him can enter. And those people who, you know, left him out 10 years ago were not let in anymore. So I think there is a revenge and there is a pride, there is a promise of greatness, and the basic need of human, of being considered, you know, as human being is there. I'm like, all these are all are in interplay, I think, when we talk about rising right-wing populism.
The book goes on to discuss the idea of what you call terrorizing language, completely abandoning rationale, and that anything resembling a reasonable or logical argument is just cast aside. How's this such a powerful tool, and how is it mastered?
Well, you are already experiencing it in this country right now. All of a sudden, the giant, political machine of Britain is reduced into two words: Brexit and, non-Brexit or whatever, anti-Brexit. Mm.
Or just Brexit means Brexit.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is how you terrorize it. I mean, and people start thinking that this is politics, throwing words at each other and, having a huge fight around one word. This is terrorizing. This is like cornering the entire human mind into one corner and creating anger and outrage out of it. So diminishing the human mind and the giant concept of politics into this little box is terrorizing. It's kind of mental imprisonment, in fact.
Mm. I think you used the example of trying to set up an Aristotelian dialogue or Socratic dialogue, I guess, but it was just falls apart completely because...
Yeah, there's a funny dialogue. Yeah. Aristo talking to a right-wing populist. I seriously wanted to decipher, ordinary conversation with a right-wing populist and how they dismantle the entire logic of conversation, entire logic of deduction, let's say. So how schizophrenic it is. And if you compare any kind of conversation with a populist to that Aristo conversation in the book, I think you'll see many similarities because it's the same code over and over again. Yeah. It's the same logic over and over again. That's why I keep saying we have to see through the confusion, because going into such a dialogue is exhausting for a sane person. You do not only get paralyzed, but also it's making you angry and you lose your mind, sort of. And how long can you do it anyway? So we have to take a step back and see what we are going through as the critics of right-wing populism and how we are responding to the things going around us and to such conversations. There's a big, debate. It has been going on in Britain, in, European countries, and in the United States. How much of a space should we give them?
Yeah.
That is, and that became an ethical question. And we are self-searching, soul-searching. We are, self-beating about it. In order to understand what really is going on, if they're giving the space, I think we have to see what they are doing when they are given the space, and how they are operating in that space. That's why I try to decipher the, main logic of right-wing populism in the book.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come.
And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I think that there's a point in the book where you mention that, you know, in the early days of the AK being power in Turkey, they tried to court you as a potentially friendly voice in the media and many other people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How did that go down?
That kind of blew up. But yeah, one thing is that these things, you know, buying out the journalist or buying out the intellectual happens in a very sophisticated way, like Second World War movies or so. It doesn't happen like that. It's completely banal, and I was actually offended by the banality of it as well. Like, I was expecting more. They just said, you know, write good things about us and then you'll have a better future. And then of course I was outraged, and I, you know, knocked on the tables and said, like, how dare you, and then, you know, I saw how they do there, in fact, how to do that, and, you know, here I am living in Zagreb. To cut the story very, very short.
But I suppose Turkey is a kind of odd example, because eventually they did just, you know, they just shut down all the media they didn't like. But I think there's also a sense, you know, there is, and we see here in certain newspapers have just gone, you know, insanely kind of chasing after this, you know, unbidden almost, trying to look like they're in touch with this this zephyr kind of floating through. But there's also the element, you know, that they feel they don't need to engage, and, you know, no one in UKIP is going to spend a lot of time trying to get a piece in The Guardian explaining their case. No one seems to be trying to convince anyone before, and it comes back to, I think, what you're saying with the dialogue, the Aristotelian dialogue about, yeah, it's not about, you know, a dialogue should be reaching towards a conclusion, whereas what they want is sides.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everything is set out to force you to pick a side.
I don't want to cross my limit and make, you know, a lot of comments about British politics and the particularities of it. But I have to ask the question then to you, do they really need it? I mean, like, they already shaped the entire politics, since 2 years. We're talking about UKIP and Nigel Farage. They are, you know, their ideas are already in circulation, and they are actually, you know, shaping and leading the way, shaping the politics and leading the political path. So they don't really need to, publish a piece in Guardian, because Boris Johnson published pieces in Guardian in several newspapers, or Theresa May, as well, you know, writes things. So I do think that they already did their job and they must be happy about it.
And they don't care.
Yeah.
But there is always a sense that any populist must be under attack from the establishment all the time. And this is something where you can see, you know, even in the past year, the direct line from Turkey to Washington to London. So the people in London, people like Farage and Boris Johnson and, of course, Trump, have started very seriously talking about the concept of the deep state, which very, as a political concept is entirely Turkish in origin.
Yes, we imagined it. And it's so funny for me to see books now called, like, deep state. And you know what? It's so funny. 10 years ago, I was trying to write piece, when I was writing writing pieces for foreign media, for English media, I was trying to explain them what deep state is, and they wouldn't understand. And now they're writing their own books about deep state, which is so funny. Like, you know, well, I wish things would turn out differently, but obviously they want to learn from us, from Turkey. And yeah, they're good at it. And the funny part of the story, one of the funny parts of this story, well, it's not that funny, but we can still laugh at it. You know, what happens in the United States and Britain is far faster than what happened in Turkey. Mm-hmm. It took us 15 years to get exhausted, and we were the first experiment. So it was really difficult for me and people like me to explain what's happening in Turkey to Europeans. Mm-hmm. They were in love with Recep Tayyip Erdogan and AKP party. And then we were trying to explain them something else is happening. We cannot really put our finger on it, but it's really, really dangerous. And then they were saying, no, this is democracy. The, you know, the reality of Turkey is coming out. Now, unfortunately, tables are turned. And now, you know, I have to tell them, okay, you left us alone, but I am not leaving you alone because we are together mm-hmm. in this shit.
Just so briefly about, you know, what is happening in Turkey?
Right now?
What do we have to look forward to?
No, I don't think that everything is going to happen in the same way. That would be too crude. But what is happening emotionally among people is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. That astonishment, that, you know, paralyzation, and the feeling of, is this still my country? Am I out of touch with everything? Or do I have to leave this country now? And so on. You know, Europe is like musical chairs right now. Everybody is trying to change places. You know, British people are queuing up in embassies to get European Union passports. French people do not know what to do. Americans are, you know, trying, some of them are planning to leave the country and so on. So what's in that sense, I know what they are going through. Funny story, I had the first event in Frontline Club, and there was one guy from the audience who voted leave in the referendum, in Brexit referendum. So he said proudly, well, it's easy to understand United States, but Great Britain, you know, you cannot understand Great Britain. It's complicated. And you shouldn't be talking about Great Britain, da, da, da. And then I said, I know I shouldn't be, but I know how you feel. For years, British and American intellectuals and journalists came to my country and mm-hmm. simplified everything for me. And I know how you feel, and I'm afraid the tables are turned. And I do really know how you feel. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're recording this with, you know, less than 50 days going on before, you know, Britain supposedly officially leaves the EU, but who can say? We've no idea what the deal's going to be. We're still going backwards and forwards, you know, arguing over. I think the vast majority of people aren't even sure what we're arguing about anymore. There's something you describe in your book about the old the Ottoman tax collector coming across the village in the dancing phase.
Yeah, dancing phase.
Explain that concept, and I guess I wonder how close we are to it.
Yeah, when you say in Turkey we are at the dancing phase, they would know the story, so they would laugh anyway. That's the dancing phase is, I think, Britain is close to that phase as well, a little bit, you know, or they're going to come closer as 29th of March gets closer. Okay, the story goes like this. Ottoman Sultan is, you know, cruel, and he's raising up taxes constantly, and the villagers are hungry. And each time the tax collector goes to the village, they cry, they beg, don't raise the taxes, and so on. And each time they cry, and, you know, the story goes on, and at the final stage, the tax collector goes to the village, and he sees that the entire village is dancing. And then he runs back to the Sultan, and he says, we have to stop this. They're at the dancing phase. So, yeah, you know, there comes a phase where you feel numb, and the only, you know, thing you feel like is enjoying the ride. And I know this from Beirut as well. I was in Beirut after Israeli attack in 2006, and I traveled to the Israeli border. People were, you know, Red Cross was burying the dead bodies, and when they gave a break, they were dancing mm-hmm. and singing. And I thought this was insane. And in a different way, on a more sophisticated way, I think several countries right now is experiencing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They are burying their hopes about, you know, democracy or a better future, and they're dancing on their on the graves, basically.
Mm. That's cheery.
Yeah.
So, but we went from yeah, you describe, and put some of those most eloquent, beautifully written pieces in the book are about the arc from kind of particularly 2013 with Gezi, and the kind of we've gone from the carnival of 2011 to 2013,
yeah.
And you know, you predate that, you know, to consider the resistant, the globalized resistant type thing and that kind of thing. How did we get from there, that kind of joyous kind of expression of you know, a common purpose, for want of a better phrase, to this bleak kind of death dance we're in now?
Well, I have to say something. This book is not depressive. No,
it is not.
No, seriously not. And I don't want to depress people. And because I do believe that we can solve this, we can get out of this confusion. They were suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
People in Gezi and, you know, in Cairo, in Tahrir, and several other places, they were suppressed. And some of them were, you know, swallowed by the conventional politics, like mm-hmm. in Spain and so on. But I think there's a difference. It was, you know, that one came out of anger too. But we celebrated of being human there in every square of the world. But this anger that we are seeing right now, the anger of, so to speak, real people, is a different angle, anger. And as far as I can see, there is one main difference in between two masses. Gezi, Tahrir, all those squares, we're talking about human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the angry masses of right-wing populism, they're talking about pride.
Mm.
And these are, although it seems they are, you know, close to each other, pride and dignity, they are so far away from each other. And I think when you are really defeated and when you really lose the hope of having dignity, you hold on to your pride as the last chance. And unfortunately, we are there. I'm like, I wish those movements, Gezi, you know, Tahrir, or Seattle, you know,
yeah,
whatever happened in the United States, I wish they were taken seriously. Because if they were taken seriously, if they were considered as, you know, citizens of the world, first-class citizens of the world, those you know, resistance activists and so on, we could have ended up in a different place. But, you know, the conventional politics sort of blocked that energy, and now we have a different mess. And unfortunately, it's going, you know, ironically, it is now this mass of real people is threatening the establishment.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do we do now? I'll put you on the spot there.
I love this question. I love this question. Okay, take a deep breath.
Mm-hmm.
No, seriously, take a deep breath. And you don't have to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to feel anything. This might sound heartless or stone-hearted to many, but by feeling too much, you cannot change anything in politics. You have to understand it. And understanding is not a solo performance. We have to do it together. And as we start this global conversation about what to do, the answer will come from that collective. I am very sure, 100% sure of it. Because this rising right-wing populism cannot be defeated in only one country. It should be a supranational movement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
How to Lose a Country by Ajay Tamilkaran is published by Fourth Estate and available now. This episode of Little Atoms was presented by me, Patrick Reedy, and edited by Sky Redman. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. And remember to check out littleatoms.com for a full archive. Thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.